All right, good morning, everybody. We've got Bio 241. And today is October 21st. I thought I was ready for it this time. Okay, now I'm ready for it. And we're going to continue with the muscle chapter today. Maybe finish it, maybe not. I'm not too sure. We'll see how that goes. Here is the sign-in sheet. All right, so please sign in. And let's see, what do we have going? SI, I presume, is just going as usual. There's no notices for that. When is SI, anyway? Is it after class or before class? It's after class, okay. All right, so today's the 21st. We have an exam on the 28th, which means it is a week away. All right, so next Thursday, you've got a lecture exam. And what's going to be on that test? It's going to be, Chapter 9, Autonomic Nervous System, Chapter 10, Sensory, and Chapter 11, Endocrinology. That's what's on the test. Anybody have any questions on that? No. What about questions on muscle? Anybody got questions on muscle so far? No, good. Because that's just kind of a review so far of anatomy. Even what I'm talking about right now is kind of a review of anatomy. So, let's see. What's the organelle of contraction? Not the cell, right? The cell is just a fiber, muscle fiber. What's the organelle inside of a muscle cell that can shorten? That's pretty close. Sarcomere is pretty good. Sarcomere, I think, is a structural and functional unit of contraction, but I wouldn't necessarily call it an organelle, right? An organelle is a completely contained structure, you know, like mitochondria, Golgi apparatus, nucleus, right? But the unit of organelle for contraction is this long, where's my cursor? Cursor, come on. Ah, here it is. Let me make sure it doesn't disappear. Visible. Should have been visible the whole time. All right, so these long tubular structures inside of a muscle cell are called myofibrils. All right, so myofibrils are the organelles for contraction. All right, and the basic building block of a myofibril is that there's this repeating unit over and over and over and over and over again, and that's a sarcomere. Right, so the sarcomere is what's used as a building block to make a myofibril. And all these sarcomeres contract together, which then will shorten the myofibril. And as a matter of fact, all of these myofibrils within the fiber will contract, and that's going to cause the whole muscle fiber to contract. All right, so we got a muscle fiber, right? And a muscle fiber is a very long cell. It contains many nuclei because during development, thousands of precursor cells fuse together to form this long fiber cell. So we see many nuclei in there. All right, and so what is the building block of a sarcomere goes from this dark line over to this dark line over here. All right, so we should know the building block of the sarcomeres, or you could think of the building blocks of a myofibril are the proteins themselves. And those proteins we call myofilaments. You're going to have to know the names of a couple of these myofilaments, but the two that are most important for contraction are the thick filaments and the thin filaments. And the thick filaments block a lot of light, and so they give the area of a sarcomere kind of a dark color. Right? So those are the thick filaments. Where you only have thin filaments, that area of the sarcomere looks a lot lighter. It passes a lot more light through that region of the sarcomere, and those are what we call thin filaments. Furthermore, you got to remember that the thin filaments right here are what we call actin, and the thick filaments are what we call myosin. And if we now just look at one sarcomere within a myofibril, the endpoints of a sarcomere are these Z lines or Z disks. You should think of them as a three-dimensional structure, so it's really more like a disk than a line, and the same thing over here. So the end of one sarcomere means that it's also the beginning of what? The next sarcomere. And so this is just a repeating pattern over and over again. And the thin filaments are actin. You can see those in blue. And the thick filaments, or myosin, you can see them in a really washed out Orange color. What colors are these things? Green? Okay, green. And we got blue right here. All right, so which one of those two myofilaments attach to the Z-disc? Which one attaches to the Z-disc? Okay, not actin and myosin, only one. Yeah, only actin attaches to the Z-disc. Look at this myosin. It's in the middle of the sarcomere, but is not attached to the Z-disc. Okay, so when we look at this structure right here, we see different areas, and I think in anatomy you had to learn this, right? You have these light bands right here where there is no myosin within the sarcomere at all, and that's easy to remember because what's the vowel that you have in light? I, right? So the I band is the light band right here, and the dark band, the real name for the dark band is the A band because you have the thick myosin filaments in there. Okay. And the myosin we see pretty much right in the center of the sarcomere. And indeed, it is located right inside the sarcomere because there are certain proteins that help anchor it right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. Where there's no overlap of actin molecules, there's a little bit of a lighter area right smack in the middle of the A band. We call that the H zone. So the darkest part of a sarcomere is where you have myosin, right, because that's the thick filament, but also where there's overlap with the actin molecule. Okay, so those are all these bands and zones and discs you have to know, and you got to know the endpoints of a sarcomere. All right, as a matter of fact, remember this zigzagged line right here, Z-disc, right, is really a three-dimensional structure. So here you see it in a little bit more of a three-dimensional kind of illustration. And if we look at a transverse section of a myofibril, that we see a nice electron micrograph right here. This is the pattern, right? We see hundreds and hundreds of actin and myosin filaments in here. So you can see a thick filament right where I have the cursor, right? That's a thick filament right there because it looks thick compared to the other ones. What is that? What's the name of that protein? That's myosin, right? And surrounding every myosin, you have these smaller filaments. What are the smaller filaments? Yeah, that's actin, right? So around every myosin filament, it is completely surrounded by actin. And as a matter of fact, then if you change your attention and look at an actin molecule, what is it surrounded by? It's surrounded by myosin. So the arrangement of these proteins is such that every myosin is surrounded by actin and that every actin is surrounded by myosin. And that's going to be important because there's an important interaction between actin and myosin that's going to cause shortening of this sarcomere. And as a matter of fact, if this sarcomere shortens, so does every sarcomere inside the myofibril. They all shorten together. All right, so it's important to look at this micrograph and appreciate that. You also have the sarcoplasmic reticulum labeled in this diagram right here. And what's the more common name for sarcoplasmic reticulum? Yeah, it's an endoplasmic reticulum of what kind? Smooth. Yeah, it's a smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So its function is not for protein synthesis, but in muscle cells, its function is a reservoir for calcium ions. So there are calcium ATP pumps, right, in the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which are constantly using ATP, but pumping calcium from low concentration in the cytosol to high concentration inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? And so you, in order to go from high to low, you need what? An energy source. And ATP is used for that energy source. So that's a nice reservoir for calcium. All right, so this probably right here is an exam figure. And again, it just goes over the sarcomere with just a little bit more detail. All right, so the sarcomere goes from Z-disc to Z-disc. And the M line is a little bit of a dark line right here because there's a protein that anchors the myosin right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. The H zone is an intermediate darkness within the sarcomere, which only contains myosin, but the darkest area, all right, is right here where you see overlap between actin and myosin. So if you look at the end of one myosin to the other end, that's what we call the A band. Right in there. And where there is no myosin, right, that's what we're going to call, it's not labeled on this slide, but you should label that. What is that? That's the I band, the light band right there. All right, so you see actin And if you look at this actin molecule, it's a long and filamentous molecule, but you can see some of the subunits right here. Right? And if we look at one subunit right there, what's the shape of that subunit? It looks like what? Is it long and narrow? Or is it square? I don't know if you can see it. Can you see it on the screen? It kind of looks round, right? So actin actually is made up of long strings of globular actin molecules to make that filament right here. All right, so sometimes we call that G-actin. It's a globular actin. The other protein that you see on this diagram, which I don't think we saw on the others, is this titin filament. Right, and this titin filament kind of looks like a little tail on a pig, okay? And it's what? It's coiled, it's curled around. And that's supposed to represent that it's like a spring. And a spring has elasticity to it, so that when you stretch a spring and then let go, what happens to the spring? It goes back to its original length. But what else happens to a spring? If you compress it, right, and then let go, what happens to it? It goes back to its original length as well, right? All right, so that elasticity also means that this muscle will go back to its resting length, right, and it's determined by this titin filament. The titin really can't cause muscle contraction actively. It just is going to force this distance of the sarcomere or the length of the sarcomere to go back to its original resting length, whether it is contracted or if it's stretched out, okay, just passively. All right, the other thing that we notice on this diagram right here, that there are some processes sticking off of the myosin molecule right here. And we need to understand what this is because we have to look at the relationship between myosin and actin. And that's going to tell us how a muscle contracts. All right, so these are head groups coming off of the myosin molecule. All right, so that's pretty much everything about a sarcomere in terms of its structure. All right, and the model that we use to think about muscle contraction or how a sarcomere contracts is what we call the sliding filament theory of contraction. Right, so this has been proven many, many times over. This is a nice theory. It's not just a wild guess. All right, so to kind of get started with this, I could ask you, if a sarcomere shortens, all right, it certainly makes a lot of sense that the proteins inside that sarcomere are going to shorten as well. So we know what are the two main myofilaments that make up a sarcomere. They are the actin and myosin. So the question would be, which one of those two filaments actually shorten when a sarcomere shortens? Is it the actin molecule that gets shorter or the myosin molecule that gets shorter? Okay, and maybe some of you have studied this, right? And you'll see that that's kind of a trick question, because we're going to see that neither of those filaments actually shorten. All right, so that kind of leaves us with a mystery. But let's just see how a sarcomere can shorten if nothing inside the sarcomere shortens. Okay, and that's because muscle contracts because the myofibrils get shorter, right? And the building block of a myofibril are those sarcomeres that somebody mentioned, and the building block of a sarcomere are those myofilaments. Right, but a sarcomere shortens because the thin filaments slide over in between the thick filaments towards the center. And when these filaments slide over each other, that shortens the distance from one Z disc to the other. Right, and therefore a sarcomere shortens because of the myofilaments sliding over each other. So here we have an illustration of two sarcomeres in different states of contraction. All right, but so here is a sarcomere because we see a Z disc, right, and a Z disc, and another Z disc. So there are two sarcomeres. Here's that H zone and the A band, and then here is the I band over here. And we can see that the actin is connected to the Z disc and that there's interdigitation between these two different kinds of filaments. And when a muscle is told to contract, right, what actually happens? The Z discs come together. And if we look at an actin molecule, let's look at a length of this actin molecule and compare it when the sarcomere is partially contracted, compare that length to when the sarcomere is completely relaxed. All right, and what can you tell me about the length of these two, of this actin molecule at these two different times? It looks the same. And then let's maximally contract the muscle and look at the length of actin and compare it to when it's partially contracted and when it's relaxed. And look at the length of actin. It's the same length. All right, so actin certainly does not contract. And now let's look at myosin. From when it's relaxed to when it's partially contracted, the length is the same. And when this when these sarcomeres are fully contracted, look at myosin. It is exactly the same length at all. The only thing that you notice, right, is that there is greater overlap between actin and myosin molecules. All right, so these filaments are sliding over each other. And when that happens, let's look and see what happens to some of these bands, like the H-band. What happens to the H-band? Does it stay the same or does it change? It changes. It gets smaller, right? So it gets smaller as the contraction proceeds. It doesn't necessarily completely disappear, but almost completely disappears. What about another band that disappears as these filaments slide over each other? Look at this I band right here. It gets smaller and smaller as well. Okay, so both the H zone and that I band disappear when muscle contracts. All right, and so that's actually how this guy Huxley figured out exactly how muscle contracts, right? Because he knew something about actin and myosin, but didn't know exactly how things were going. But just looking at different micrographs and looking at these areas that disappeared during contraction, he was able to deduce how things worked. Well, we know a lot more about muscle contraction now. Okay, and I think this is everything that we've talked about so far, so I'm not going to read that slide to you. All right, but let's really zoom in and take a look at actin and myosin, all the different parts that make up these molecules right here. So a good place to start, I think, is on the thick filament. So the thick filament has these processes sticking off of them, and these are what we call myosin head groups. And this part that reaches up is called the myosin tail. And here we have the myosin head, and the myosin head has got a couple important areas on it. There is an actin binding site on the tip of the head, and then there is another active site on the myosin head group that is an ATP binding site. And this head group right here is also an ATPase. All right, so the myosin head is an ATPase. What the heck does that mean? It's an enzyme, right? ASE means it's an enzyme. And what's its substrate? Okay, what is its substrate? What about lactase? What's the substrate for lactase? It is lactose. What about lipase? What's the substrate? Lipid. So what's the substrate for ATPase? It's ATP. Okay, so the myosin is an ATPase. There's a binding site for ATP, so ATP can enter the binding site, and then it can be hydrolyzed, right? The terminal phosphate can be hydrolyzed from ATP, producing what? ADP and inorganic phosphate. Now, what kind of reaction is that? Is that an endergonic or exergonic reaction? Exergonic, yeah, in a big way. A lot of energy is released, and this myosin group right here knows how to use that energy. It changes a conformation, right? So instead of having this cock right here, instead of this 90-degree bend in this myosin group, right, it straightens out when ATP is hydrolyzed. So that energy in ATP is used to straighten this molecule out, and there is now a lot of energy in this conformation of the molecule. The energy in ATP is now stored in this straight form of ATP, or the straight form of this myosin group right here. All right, so let's kind of focus our attention for the time being back up to the thin filament. And another name for a thin filament is actin. Yeah, it's actin, and you can see the globular nature of the G-actin molecules that have been strung together. But we see some other molecules along this actin molecule. We see this long filamentous molecule that strings along, right? And this is what we call tropomyosin. And then every once in a while, that there's another molecule attached to tropomyosin, and that one is called troponin. So here we have troponin, and it's about every 7 subunits or so you're supposed to see another troponin molecule. And Tropomyosin is similar to a molecule that we looked at already. There's a cousin molecule called calmodulin. Can anybody remember what calmodulin was all about? What did it, what, how did it associate itself? Or what was its purpose inside cells? Yeah, it likes to bind calcium, right? And when calcium is bound to calmodulin, it could either activate or inactivate enzymatic processes inside the cell. So it's kind of like a regulatory protein that can bind calcium. So troponin is very similar. It can bind calcium as well, and that's what's going to regulate sliding of these filaments right here. All right, let me just read and see if I have to mention anything else. No, the head group sliding the filaments. Okay, so don't forget, there on this head group right here, there's an actin binding site, and there's an ATP binding site, and it binds ATP because this head group is also an ATPase. Now, there's something else. On actin, each one of these actin molecules, there is a domain that can bind myosin. All right, so what did we call this part on myosin head group? It can bind to actin, so that's an actin binding site. And what is it going to attach to? It's going to attach to the myosin binding site on an actin molecule. Now, when a muscle is at rest, those myosin binding sites on actin are covered up by this big long molecule right here that we call tropomyosin. So there's no way for a cross bridge to form, right? A cross bridge is this myosin tail and head group bound to an actin molecule. There's no way for that to form because the myosin binding site is covered up when the muscle is at rest. Okay, so this is what can happen, or this is part of how muscle contracts. All right, so ATP is necessary to straighten out this molecule, right, to straighten out this myosin head group right here. And when there's a proper signal, for instance, when, and I'll tell you what that signal is, when calcium is high inside the cell, then this myosin, then this actin binding site on myosin can bind to the myosin binding site on actin. Right, and since this is an ATPase, ATP, in order to get into this configuration, ATP has been hydrolyzed, leaving ADP and inorganic phosphate. And when inorganic phosphate leaves the active site, look what happens to the conformation of this myosin head group right here. Right? It swivels, or you could say it ratchets. It goes back to the original location. Right? So it moves, it kind of like flexes. This is what we call the power stroke. And when it flexes, what does it do? It pulls actin to the right. That whole actin filament moves to the right. So that's what we call the power stroke. And the power stroke is due to release of inorganic phosphate. So now we have an ATP molecule in the binding site right here. And then that is released. And when it's released, what can happen? You have now a bare binding site for ATP, and then another ATP can bind to the myosin head group. All right, so let's see if we can go through the whole cycle of muscle contraction. All right, and so I think I want to start right here. All right, like on step number 5. So here we have, where do I have the cursor right now? Myosin, the thick filament. Up over here is the thin filament. Right, and then we have a binding site for actin on the myosin head. There are myosin binding sites on these G-actins right here. And notice that they're not bound together at this point in time. And ATP then binds to the ATP binding site, and the myosin head group is also what? An ATPase. When ATP is hydrolyzed, look what can happen. This head group can change conformation. It can straighten out. All right, so it straightens out. You no longer have ATP because that energy was used to straighten that myosin head group out like that. And when it's straightened, right, it has the ability now to actually bind to the actin molecule. So it goes ahead and binds to the actin molecule. When PI is released, what happens? The power stroke happens. It goes back to the original conformation, ADP is released, and then that allows another ATP to bind to the ATP binding site. And when it does, what's the difference between step number four right here, and step number five. Okay? How would you describe the difference between these two? There's a step that happens right here. What's the difference between here and here? Okay? Two important things, and you're probably both, everybody's saying those two things at the same time. The first thing is what? The second circumstance over here, ATP is now bound to the myosin head group. But when ATP binds to the myosin head group, look what happens to the association between myosin and actin. It dissociates. All right, so that's a very important step. Myosin cannot dissociate from an actin molecule unless what is present? ATP. So ATP doesn't cause the binding of the head group to actin. It actually causes the release of the head group from the actin molecule. Okay? And what does and that happens before ATP hydrolysis? And then what does the hydrolysis of ATP do? It causes the conformation change, right? And that energy is stored in the myosin head group. Right, and then once it's straightened out, then the myosin can rebind to the actin molecule. And the next step is release of inorganic phosphate causes the power stroke. Okay, and now this myosin head group is stuck to actin unless what happens? Unless ATP is present and binds to the myosin head group. Then it can release and the process can repeat itself over and over and over again. Okay. So, and when this conformation changes, right, in this myosin head group, that causes actin to slide over the myosin myofilament, right? And this happens over and over and over again. And remember, what surrounds every myosin filament right here? Actin, right? So this happens 360 degrees around the myosin molecule, right? So there's hundreds of these head groups that can bind to actin. And when it is, right, we call it a bridge, a cross bridge between myosin and actin right here. So ATP is necessary to drive this reaction, but most importantly, ATP is necessary to, what, cause the release of the head group from actin. And that kind of describes a paradoxical situation. When somebody dies, right, what happens to a person's muscles after maybe about 4 or 5 hours? Are they completely flaccid? They're not. They're actually contracted. That condition called rigor mortis, right, is explained by this mechanism right here. Because when you're dead, of course, you can't make any ATP because there's no oxygen going to mitochondria. When ATP is depleted, what is the state of all the cross bridges? They're all connected together because in order to cause the release, what do you need? You need ATP, but that's just what the muscle fiber no longer has. Right, and so a person's muscle does go into rigor mortis because that ATP is depleted within those cells. Okay, so that's a pretty important cycle. There's some really good videos that I have for you in Blackboard and some little video quizzes you can take to make sure that you understand that cycle right there. All right, but let's see how muscle contraction is controlled. Not the exact mechanism, but the control of contraction. All right, and the control is due to this troponin-tropomyosin complex right here. So it acts like a switch that can turn muscle contraction on, and it can turn muscle contraction off, which is what we call relaxation. When we turn contraction off, that's relaxation. So this tropomyosin molecule lies in a little groove that's formed by all of the myosin binding sites. So right now, I can't see any myosin binding sites because they're hidden. They're covered up by this tropomyosin molecule. All right, and then we have this troponin complex right here that can bind calcium. All right, so let's see what the next step is. When a muscle is relaxed, right, I can't see any myosin binding sites. It's covered up by the tropomyosin. And this occurs when the calcium concentration is less than about 10 micromolar, right, 10 to the minus 6 molar concentration. Right? But when the calcium concentration gets greater than 10 to the minus 6 or 10 micromolar, contraction occurs because the tropomyosin moves out of the way and reveals the myosin binding sites on the actin molecule. Okay, so here we have the actin molecule, tropomyosin. And here's troponin, and there is a binding site right here for calcium. So right now this binding site is kind of covered up by the tropomyosin molecule. When calcium binds to troponin, it pushes tropomyosin out of the way and it reveals this binding site. And then we have a crossbridge that forms, right? Because tropomyosin is now moved out of the way. And if there's ATP present during this process, then you will get what crossbridge cycling, which we saw in this diagram right here. And that's going to cause myosin to slide over the actin molecule. All right, so calcium kind of acts like a switch because it can bind to troponin, moving tropomyosin out of the way so that cross bridges can form between the actin and myosin molecule. All right, so where does that calcium come from? Here's an illustration probably that you're kind of familiar with from anatomy. All right, so what kind of cell are we looking at right here? Are we looking at lots of cells or one cell, or what the heck are we looking at? It's just one cell. Even though it is multinuclear, it's still just a muscle fiber. That's just something that's a characteristic of a voluntary skeletal muscle. And then these things right here are the organelles for contraction. Right, these are the myofibrils, and inside the myofibrils you can see that it's made up of the myofilaments. And if we look at a nice longitudinal projection of a myofibril, you can see the dark band, right, and the light band and the Z-discs right here. So remember, from this Z-disc to this Z-disc over here is a sarcomere, right? And so the sarcomere is the structural and functional unit of contraction that's going to shorten this myofibril, right, which is going to then shorten the whole muscle fiber. Okay. These things that we see that surround every myofibril, all right, I suppose it would be nice if I could tell you what color that is. Kind of looks gray, green, okay. Really lousy green color, right? Okay. So here is green. This is the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So it's a loose network that forms over the myofibrils, but there are some terminal ends to the sarcoplasmic reticulum that we call terminal cisternae that you can see are larger. So don't forget, these things right here store calcium. There are calcium ATP pumps that are working all the time, pumping calcium from the cytosol into sarcoplasmic reticulum. Right, and in between the ends of the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, there's something that we call a transverse tubule, because how is it arranged? Like in a transverse section of the muscle fiber right there. And it's a special kind of tube, and it's connected to the plasma membrane of the muscle cell. And muscle cells are kind of interesting because they act a lot like nerve fibers. Right? We looked at the neuromuscular junction last time, and we saw that in the neuromuscular junction there are ligand-gated channels, namely what, nicotinic-type receptors that open up when acetylcholine binds to that receptor. It depolarizes the cell. But right in that same region, there's another kind of protein, another kind of membrane channel, right, that neurons don't have near their ligand-gated channels. But ligand-gated channels and this other channel coexist in the membrane underneath the neuromuscular junction. And what's that other kind of channel that you find only along axons and neurons? Voltage-gated channels, right? So you have voltage-gated channels all over the plasma membrane of a muscle fiber cell, but also in these transverse tubules. And if you have voltage-gated channels, what can propagate over the surface of these membranes right here? Action potentials, right? So a nerve fiber and a muscle fiber share that same kind of characteristic, but the motif is a little bit different, because on a neuron, you only have voltage-gated channels in an axon. But on a muscle cell, you have voltage-gated channels pretty much everywhere. All right, so an action potential will flow over the whole muscle cell. Okay, and it can because of this transverse tubule. So the job of the transverse tubule is to take an action potential that's on the surface of the cell and conduct it to the interior of the cell and actually surround, what, every myofibril. So action potentials can surround every myofibril deep inside the cell because of these transverse tubule systems. Okay, now what about calcium? Where is calcium high on a cell? Is it high on the outside or high on the inside? It's high on the outside. This is correct. All right, and so you shouldn't have very much calcium inside the cell except when it's sequestered by this sarcoplasmic reticulum. So that's a nice reservoir. All right, so let's look at something that we call excitation-contraction coupling. So this is going to be a story that shows you how a muscle cell can be excited electrically, right? And what's the typical kind of way that you think about excitation of a cell? What's the first part of an action potential? Yeah, depolarization. So what? So sodium entering the cell, right? So depolarization, right? Is, I guess, what I was trying to think about. So here you have a nice motor neuron, so a nice somatic motor neuron coming down to this muscle. So here's a neuromuscular junction, and it's going to release acetylcholine. So number one right here, these are the nicotinic receptors. These are the ligand-gated channels. And also within the neuromuscular junction, or for sure right in the periphery of it, there are also, what, voltage-gated channels, so that whenever there's an action potential coming down the axon, that's going to start an action potential on this muscle cell, right? And there's only the possibility for producing ESPSs. At the neuromuscular junction, there's nothing that can inhibit a skeletal muscle cell. An IPSP can never happen. Right, so a muscle cell will always contract when it receives a nerve impulse. And that's what you would like a voluntary muscle to do. You don't want a voluntary muscle to make up its own mind not to contract, right? That could be fairly upsetting to any ordinary individual. All right, so then you have these voltage-gated channels that propagate the action potential over the whole sarcolemma, including deep into the muscle fiber itself. So I see voltage-gated channels there, and there should be more voltage-gated channels over here. And when that action potential moves down the transverse tubule, there are other voltage-gated channels, not necessarily for sodium, but for calcium. All right, and where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside, so calcium will then go inside of the cell, and of course further depolarize the cell, further excite the cell. But now you have calcium inside the cell. And remember, what could calcium be considered as sometimes? A second messenger, right? So that can then cause other physiologic changes inside the cell. All right, so we have calcium entering from an extracellular source, but as that voltage-gated, as an action potential moves down the transverse tubule, it excites something else, something that we call a DHP receptor, right? So it's a voltage-controlled receptor. And it's connected to another receptor in the membrane of the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It's mechanically coupled to it. And this other kind of receptor is what we call a ryanodine receptor. And when the DHP receptor feels depolarization, it changes its conformation, pulls on the ryanodine receptor, and when it does, it opens up a calcium channel in the ryanodine receptor in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Now, where is calcium high? Okay, it's outside the cell, but it's also high in the sarcoplasmic reticulum of that muscle cell. So when that ryanodine receptor opens up, calcium floods out into the cytosol of the cell. So there are two sources for calcium, one extracellular and one from within the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So you could just think of this ryanodine receptor as being like a door. Right, and how would you open up a door? You would just pull on it, right? Just a mechanical motion of your arm pulling on that door, and that's exactly how these molecules work as well. When the DHP receptor feels a voltage change, right, it pulls on the ryanodine receptor and just physically opens it up. So it's a mechanically coupled kind of receptor, and that's the first time we've ever looked at one that looks like that. All right, so now you have high concentration of calcium inside this myofibril, and what the heck can happen? I don't know what the next slide looks like. I think we kind of just talked about that already. All right. Well, what happens now when you have high calcium inside the cell? It's going to bind to something. What's it going to bind to? I guess maybe we could go back a couple slides right here. That calcium is going to bind to troponin, and it's going to move tropomyosin out of the way when it does. So that means that the actin binding site on myosin can bind to the myosin binding site on actin. And if this is a nice, healthy muscle cell that's producing ATP, you can get cycling of cross bridges and this changing in the conformation of that cross bridge that's going to pull actin and myosin over each other. They're going to slide past each other and cause that myofibril to contract. So that's excitation-contraction coupling. Here is a pretty good little flow diagram that says everything that we've talked about so far. All right, so the somatic motor neuron is going to release acetylcholine when a nerve impulse, an action potential, reaches the axon terminus. All right, so that's going to cause fusing and release of acetylcholine. It's going to diffuse across the neuromuscular cleft. Acetylcholine then binds to those nicotinic receptors, and that's going to open up that sodium channel because it's a ligand-gated channel, causing depolarization because sodium diffuses inside the cell. And in that same area, there are voltage-gated channels that then produce an action potential that will flow over the whole cell, the whole muscle cell. And as a matter of fact, it won't just stay on the surface of the muscle cell, but it will go deep to the interior of the muscle cell. What's the structure that allows that to happen? The T-tubules, right? And the T-tubules have a voltage-gated channel, so the action potential will be conducted all the way through the transverse tubule. But the T-tubule also has other kinds of membrane proteins, like the DHP receptor. All right, when it depolarizes, it's going to open up a calcium channel, so calcium can enter the cell. But these DHP receptors are also coupled to mechanically, right, just physically connected to the ranodine receptor, and that will open up even more calcium channels. And these calcium channels are bigger. They're even 10 times bigger in diameter than the ryanodine receptor itself. So a lot of calcium floods the myofibril. And then that diffuses to troponin, right? And that's going to stimulate sliding of the myofilaments over each other, which is going to produce contraction. Okay, so now how does muscle relaxation take place? All right, so the controlling molecule for cross bridge formation is calcium, right, when it binds to troponin. So muscle relaxation takes place when calcium concentrations decrease. And they start to decrease, all right, let's go back to this slide. They start to decrease if there are no action potentials in the transverse tubule right here, because there is a calcium pump that is always active in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And it's always pumping calcium back into this reservoir. And if there are no action potentials, there are no signals to keep any of these calcium channels open. So the process that wins out is what? The sequestration of calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when the calcium levels decrease, then the tropomyosin molecule covers up the binding sites for myosin on the actin molecule. Cross bridges can't form, and the muscle then goes back to its normal resting length because of the titin molecule, right? Because of the normal elasticity that muscle has. Can you picture where that titin molecule was? How far back do we have to go? Pretty far right here. All right, so if there are no cross bridges that form, this tight molecule then causes the sarcomere to go back to its original resting length. So that is controlled by calcium. All right, so you guys got to ask me some questions. Now, do you know enough to ask any questions yet about this stuff? Yeah. Oh, you know, we're going to talk about that right now. In the lecture slides, I don't have trepe. I have summation, which has to do more with tetanus formation. But I have an easy way to think about trepe, and it's actually the same explanation than for the that you have for summation as well in a muscle. Okay, so yeah, I'll go over it. Okay.
Although you said that a voluntary muscle can't have a IPS, inhibitory.
Oh, it does. Yeah.
So what happens like when you're afraid and you try to run and you freeze up? What happens then?
What happens then? Okay. That was a pretty good question. Sometimes people freeze if they're given a really severe kind of stimulus, right? Like a life-threatening kind of stimulus. So why is it, if you can't inhibit a muscle, why is it that people freeze up, for instance? That, I think, is the essence of your question right there, okay? And that's because all muscles in your body are being stimulated at the same time. And what's the general architecture of your musculoskeletal system? You have muscles that are designed to flex, and you have muscles that are designed to, to extend. Both of, if they both contract, right? Contraction of the biceps causes flexion. Contraction of the triceps causes extension. But if they both contract together, what happens? Ah, then you kind of freeze. Okay, so it's not inhibition of any muscles. It is excitation of both flexors and extensors at the same time that causes you to freeze. Okay? So that's how I would think of that happening. Right? So it's not an inhibition. It is just an inappropriate control. It's the excitation of both extensors and flexors. Typically, flexors are a little bit stronger. So if you freeze, you probably freeze a little bit more in a flexed condition than an extended condition. But would be the same thing. So the beauty of antagonistic systems is that if you give the same input for contraction and relaxation, what do? It cancels out. And in most circumstances, right, when you stimulate both flexors and extensors at the same time, it just means that it's a noisy signal. And so noise cancels out, but in this particular condition, it's not noise, it's what just extreme. It's an extreme stimulus that does that. Yeah. Yeah, question.
Well, in reference to what you were just saying, is that what happens to someone when they've
hit by a Oh, this is true. They can't move because all of their muscles contract, and the ones that win out are the stronger ones, which usually are the flexors. Not necessarily so. Like there's some extensors of the leg across the hip that are very strong, but when you contract all those muscles, then you can't move because your joints can't articulate. They're locked in position. Yeah. Oh, like when you have a cramp, a muscle cramp or something? Could be due to a number of different things. Maybe it's, we're going to look at something called a spindle apparatus. All right, so there are control systems that control, that help control muscles to contract in a reflex way. So you usually have conscious control of muscles, but reflexes can control muscle contraction sometimes. There could be maybe metabolic damage to a muscle. Maybe if somebody's overused a muscle, then there are pH changes inside the muscle, which then inhibit that ATP pump for calcium, pumping back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And if those aren't working optimally, then you have leftover calcium inside the muscle fiber, which is going to cause that muscle fiber to contract. Okay, and then part of the reflex is when a muscle contracts inappropriately, then the reflex activity causes the muscle to contract even more, thinking that's going to protect the muscle. But you feel that that's really not the case, right? Okay. So that's kind of it. Could be due to some metabolic effects, could be due to reflex effects, and also maybe some other ionic effects. If there's an imbalance in sodium and potassium, that's going to affect the resting membrane potential. It's going to affect depolarization and repolarization of the muscle. And so it could be a number of different things. Okay. So characteristics of muscle contraction. So this was kind of preceded by a question, what about trepe? Okay, so here we have a graph of something. Okay, it's something versus time. And when we looked at stuff like this before, it kind of looked like what? An action potential. And an action potential is what kind of signal versus time? You had to draw it out. You had to label those axes. An action potential is an illustration of, it's a graph of of some kind of physiologic parameter versus time. So this is time, I will agree, this is time down here on the horizontal axis. But for an action potential, what was the vertical axis? Yeah, voltage. It was voltage measured in millivolts, okay? But that's not what this graph is, right? This is not a graph of electrical events versus time. This is purely just a mechanical event, right? So there is a pressure transducer that was tied to either end of a muscle fiber, and when that muscle contracts, it pulls on that transducer, and it can measure the tension. So this is tension, just a mechanical measure of the tension that's produced with the muscle versus time. So it's not electrical, it's tension versus time. All right, so you see that if we stimulate a muscle, it's going to contract. And what did we say about that? It's an all or none response, right? And then it's going to relax. And then if we stimulate it again, and it looks right here, like before it completely relaxes, the second time this muscle fiber, so this is just a single muscle fiber, not a whole muscle, but just a fiber, when it contracts to what? A higher degree. Which what says what? Well, how can this be an all or none response if the next time it contracts even a little bit higher? Well, it's because the second twitch happened before all the calcium was pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So there's a little residual calcium left in the myofibril so that by the time the second time the muscle is stimulated into contracting, it can contract to a higher degree because there's more calcium inside the cell, right? And the calcium is going to allow for more cross-bridge cycling, and so the muscle is going to contract to a higher degree. All right, so this effect right here is what we call TREPE. And if we stimulate the muscle again, right, it's going to contract at a little bit higher tension because there's leftover calcium. It hasn't completely gone away. But if we wait long enough, then the next contraction is going to do what? It's going to go back to its original tension that it can produce. All right, so when we say an all or none response, we mean that, right, if the calcium concentration is the same, then this peak tension is going to be the same from contraction to contraction. All right, but there can be these small changes in gradation of tension due to leftover calcium inside the myofibril that will cause an increase in tension. All right, which is different than what we see right here. But the mechanism for explaining what's happening during tension, during tetanus, is exactly the same. So in this particular case, okay, you can consider this a muscle fiber, or you could consider this a whole muscle. And if we stimulate a whole muscle very rapidly, okay, let's look at this condition over here, very rapidly, let's just say 60 shocks per second, the muscle is going to contract and it's never going to relax, at least for this initial period over here. This is what we call complete tetanus, right? Because the muscle is being stimulated so quickly, there is no time to take calcium out of the cytosol and put back in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So cross-bridge cycling is going to take place continuously during this period of time. All right, but if we separate the stimulations out in time, right, the muscle begins to relax a little bit between the excitations. All right, and if we space out the excitation pulses out even further, you have more time for relaxation to take place. All right, so this right here is what we call summation. So if we have a muscle at rest and stimulate it to contract, and before the muscle can relax completely, we stimulate the muscle again, so there's still residual calcium left floating around the myofibrils or the myofilaments, and we stimulate it again and open up those calcium channels on the sarcoplasmic reticulum, more calcium is released, right? So now we see, what, an increase in the force of contraction. And then the muscle tries to relax again, but before it can, it's stimulated again, it releases even more calcium and more calcium with repeated shocks until, right, it reaches an equilibrium where there is kind of a constant level of calcium in the myofibril between these periods of calcium release and being pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So this is what we would call incomplete tetanus. This is incomplete tetanus because I still see some relaxation taking place. During this period of time, this is what we call complete tetanus because there's no relaxation whatsoever in the muscle fiber, but it can't go forever because when a muscle is in complete tetanus, blood cannot enter the muscle, right? Because it turns into a solid and blood can't get into it. And if blood can't get into muscle, no oxygen can either. And if there's no oxygen, what happens to the mitochondria?
No.
Yeah, they don't produce ATP, right? Other parts of the cell try to, like glycolysis works in an anaerobic fashion and produces lactic acid. So this area right here of fatigue is due to two things, right? The pH changes, lactic acid increases, but what else is also happening during this period of time? ATP concentration decreases, right? So ATP decreases, lactic acid increases, pH decreases, and this causes fatigue of the muscle. It still tries to contract as much as it can, but it can't generate the same force. So that happens during complete tetanus. Like, for instance, when you have a muscle cramp. It's not being stimulated, but for some reason, the physiology of that muscle is changed, and it goes into complete tetanus. It doesn't have oxygen, and there's a molecule that produces pain in that muscle, and that is lactic acid. All right, so when you have a cramp, it produces a lot of pain, because of the production of lactic acid and the decrease in pH. Okay, so that's produced when a muscle contracts, or any time a muscle is cut off from oxygen. It doesn't necessarily have to contract, but any time a muscle is cut off from oxygen, when can that happen? What are some circumstances that a muscle can be cut off from oxygen even though it's not in tetanus? How about when you block an artery? All right, or maybe, for instance, there could be a blood clot in that part of the blood vessel that's feeding a muscle. All right, and in particular, one muscle that's really important is your heart, right? Because your skeletal muscles you can relax, right? And when they're relaxed, they don't use up so much ATP. They use up most of the ATP when they're contracting, right? But now your heart, what about your heart? Never can take a break. It's always got to be contracting. And when it's contracting, it's using up ATP, right? When an artery gets blocked to the heart, it's like this tetanus condition right here. Right, it goes in, it starts to produce a lot of lactic acid. ATP is being used up. What happens to the force of contraction of the heart? Then it starts to decrease, which is bad. So what happens to your blood pressure? It's going to start to drop. Okay, so a lot of bad things happen in that particular case, and you also have pain receptors there. So when somebody has a blocked artery to the heart, right, it feels just like when you have a muscle cramp. How does it feel when you have a muscle cramp? Hurts like hell. Okay. Same thing when an artery to the heart is blocked. It does what? Hurts like hell. Okay. And as a matter of fact, it hurts so bad that a lot of people kind of just give up the will to live. All right. And the most important thing for somebody that is suffering from a heart attack is to get them to relax, number one. And number two is to get them to a hospital. But always reassure them, right, that even though the pain is excruciating, that it might just be a temporary thing for them, right? And it's something that they can recover from. It does not necessarily have to be life-threatening. So there are other circumstances when blood gets cut off to a muscle. For instance, maybe when the uterus contracts, smooth muscle. I don't have any idea of what that feels like, but I can imagine. It does what? It hurts like hell. Okay. There's another circumstance too. Right, so we're talking about oxygen delivery to a tissue. It could be decreased because of tetanus of a muscle, but maybe there are conditions where the blood can't carry oxygen. Right, there's a certain condition called anemia, and one in particular called sickle cell anemia. And this is when certain individuals, if they have the genetic makeup, when oxygen starts to decrease in your blood, like when you're starting to exercise a little bit or under states of dehydration, blood cells, instead of being nice and round and smooth, they kind of turn into sickle shape and they become jagged. They have jagged ends. And because they have these jagged edges on them, they can't flow through blood vessels quite as easily, especially small blood vessels. So when somebody is in sickle cell crisis, right? All of their small blood vessels everywhere in their body get plugged up with these sickled cells, right? So when somebody's in sickle cell crisis, can you imagine what does that feel like? They still have those living muscles that are producing lactic acid all over their body. What does that feel like all over their body? Well, it hurts like hell all over their body. Okay, just like when you have a muscle cramp in one part or when you have a heart attack just in your heart, for instance. All right, so what is it that we like to do for patients that are in that intractable pain all over their body even? Yeah, we use opiates, right, to control that excruciating pain. So patients in sickle cell are treated routinely, right, with blood transfusions to get over that, opiates and fluids to help that crisis. So that's kind of interesting. Remember what I said about Parkinson's disease? It kind of masks itself as what? Like when somebody's intoxicated, but they're not, right? And you can't treat them as being drug seekers, right? The same thing for somebody that's in some of these other kinds of conditions like sickle cell crisis. They're not drug seekers. They're not just seeking morphine. They're in what? Excruciating pain, and they need that proper medical attention, right? So never treat somebody in sickle cell crisis as like just being a drug seeker, right? They need that medication just to maintain their life halfway normal. Okay. Here is something pretty important. Maybe we can cover this today. Length-tension relationship. Okay, so the strength of muscle contraction is influenced or controlled by a number of different things. We saw that the frequency of contraction is going to determine the length of a muscle, also the thickness of each muscle fiber. If you have a muscle fiber that's really thick, it also means that it has more organelles inside of it. What are those organelles that are for contraction? Myofibrils, right? So if it's a thicker fiber, it has more myofibrils, which means that it contracts much more strongly. But here is something that's not too intuitive, but it will be shortly. The initial length of a muscle fiber also will determine to what strength can, or what tension can be developed by that particular muscle fiber. There is an ideal resting length, all right, that can generate a maximum amount of force, right? So we're going to look at length-tension relationships, and we're going to look at this graph right here. Okay, so we're going to look at the tension that's produced by a muscle fiber versus its resting length. So this kind of reminds me of a curve of pH versus enzyme activity. Remember, there's an optimal activity depending on the pH, and if you change the pH, the activity is going to go down. All right, so we're looking at what? Tension versus length. Therefore, we're looking at what? A length-tension relationship in muscle. And let's just start right here. As we start to stretch a muscle out and measure the tension when we stimulate that muscle, look what happens. It actually increases, right, and reaches a plateau. And then if we stretch the muscle out even more, look what happens to the tension that can be developed. It starts to go down. So there are two limbs to this particular curve. There's an ascending limb and a descending limb over here. And let's relate this particular curve to a sarcomere. So what do we have in a sarcomere? What are the endpoints of a sarcomere? Yeah, those I bands, but how about a Z disc, which is in the middle of an I band, right? It's in the middle of an I band. And what are some of the filaments inside a sarcomere? You got actin and myosin, right? And which ones of those actually shorten when a sarcomere shortens? Neither. What do? They slide over each other, right? So my wrist could be the Z discs, right? And my fingers, the actin and myosin. And when the Z discs come closer together, just means that, what? My fingers are interdigitating, right? The actin and myosin interdigitate a little bit. Okay. So in order for myosin and actin to slide over each other, there has to be overlap between them. All right, so let's look at this case over here where the muscle is really stretched out, and on this condition, it can't produce any tension whatsoever when it's overstretched. Let's look at how actin and myosin relate to each other. In this case right here, what about overlap between actin and myosin? Is there any overlap? The sarcomere is so stretched out, right, that there is no overlap between actin and myosin, so there are no cross bridges that can form between actin and myosin, and maybe the tropomyosin molecule is out of the way, maybe there's plenty of calcium in this muscle, then the myosin binding sites are available, but the myosin head group can't reach up and bind. And if it can't bind, right, then it can't cause the sliding of filaments over each other. All right, so then if we let the muscle shorten a little bit to where we have some overlap, guess what happens to the tension that it can produce? Right, then it can start to develop some tension because cross bridges can form. And in this case, I see, well, maybe three in this region right here. How could we increase the tension that's produced by this sarcomere? Shorten the sarcomere length a little bit, so what? That all of these cross bridges now can form with an actin molecule that will produce the maximum amount of tension, like to this case right here, right? And now let's go in the opposite direction, this ascending limb, right? If there is so much overlap, and the sarcomere is shortened to such a degree that the myosin now bumps up against the Z-disc, even though there is 100% overlap between the actin and myosin, this sarcomere can't shorten because the Z-discs are bumping into the myosin molecule. Right? And in this particular case, it cannot produce any tension either, which is this circumstance right here. So length-tension relationships, right, are understood by having the optimal degree of overlap between actin and myosin molecules. And this is going to be really important in our next chapter when we look at the heart. We can adjust the function of heart contraction by adjusting how much the heart fills with blood. And as the heart fills with blood, what happens to sarcomeres within the heart? They stretch out. Okay, and so a heart can be overstretched out or it can be understretched out depending on how much blood actually returns to the heart. So skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle share the same kind of phenomena. All right, so guess what? We didn't finish today. So we're going to finish next time. And then don't forget, a week from today is test 3. Okay.